Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalists. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, coming to you on May Day 2018. Victory to the international proletariat, I think, is a language we have to use. And I say that in an unironic way, because some of the Charlottesville trials have concluded with the obligatory guilty verdict. Now, any juror down there hearing a prosecutor talk about neo-Nazis and Hitler, no juror is going to vote to acquit, because they'll think that they're somehow striking a victory for fascists, or whatever they think that is. And I think pretty much that what the prosecution did to the jury is simply give them that impression. The jury can't possibly be unbiased. Same thing for Bill Cosby. They just kept having trials until they got the result they wanted. I laughed at the Bill Cosby trial. He's been targeted because he went after the left in black entertainment, as well as when he went after Eddie Murphy back in the early 80s. And the rap guys in the early 90s. And he was called everything. He was targeted pretty early on. And what made me laugh about the Cosby trial is that a quaalude is not a downer. A quaalude is, they used to call them disco biscuits in the 70s, because you would take them and you'd go dancing. They were a stimulant. And then that's only in high doses. And then you would crash, of course, like a lot of stimulants. So it got the reputation of being a quaalude is not a downer. But no one bothered to ask that. The quaalude also was canceled by food. Plus the fact that the woman here didn't have a dose high enough to fall asleep, let alone be comatose. So the thing was a complete farce. It was ridiculous. I mean, basic facts were ignored. And the same thing for the Charlottesville issue. And jurors, let's keep something in mind here about the jury system. Jurors have absolutely no standard to hold to. I mean, a judge has a better chance of sticking to the reasonable doubt standard than some guy off the street. Guy off the street doesn't know what reasonable doubt is. He doesn't know how to understand that. The average person is simply not logical. They don't get it. They know fear, and they know how to be manipulated. In both cases, you have fraud everywhere, and simply the use of media images rather than evidence. In the 1970s, the left bombed American cities almost 5,000 times. They didn't kill a lot of people. They killed about 100 people, which to them is nothing. The left had torn this country to pieces in the late 60s. And a tiny handful of these guys went to jail. Angela Davis, who ran guns for the Jackson kid who took over a Marin County courtroom in 1970, eventually killing the judge, and armed some black criminals who were there on trial or for a hearing. Angela Davis did the logistic work for that, and she never saw the inside of a jail cell, as far as I know. The Rockefeller Foundation and the First Presbyterian Church financed her legal defense, and she was a professor of philosophy at UCLA in San Diego, despite having no real education and no real knowledge, no real publications, other than, you know, her ideological stuff. And so that's the difference between the leftist terrorist and even someone who is claimed to have hurt someone who was there to kill him. I don't know how the defense operated in this case. I don't know that much about it right now. But the left was there to kill, and that includes me, because I was there. From Greensboro in the 70s to today, their stated goal is to, Antifa and the left stated goal is to destroy us physically. Hundreds of policemen have been injured, and they have torn cities to pieces protesting people who love their people. And they called it hate in this Orwellian world. When I saw the snarling faces and the contorted images of these people, media speak, rules in the courtroom. The fact that in the Cosby trial, no one bothered to ask what a Quaalude was, or could a couple of sips of Benadryl put someone out that much on a full stomach? That Bill could do whatever he wanted, despite the fact he could do whatever he wanted anyway? He didn't need drugs for that. If you're going to use drugs, he's not going to use that. Benadryl? Quaaludes? No one bothers to ask these questions. God knows what happened to the poor soul who was convicted today. Our friend in Charlottesville. That you can't have a fair trial when the prosecution is saying this is a neo-Nazi and therefore he needs to be destroyed. The left is the official ideology of American capital. It was wealthy oligarchs in America that were financing Angela Davis's legal defense and then paid for her bond and then paid for her pretending to be a scholar. And the reason I start off with that is because this is terrifying. That political organization for us is simply now impossible. The regime will use everything they can. From the 70s until now, the left has attempted to kill us on the street, has been loud about that, has hurt cops, has screamed for our blood in front of an army of policemen, cost the taxpayers hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars. And for the first time, their tactics are turned around against them. This is how they react. This is their country. And I start off this way because we're going to talk about someone who went through an almost identical situation in the Soviet Union. The difference between the Soviet Union and the United States is that the Soviets were very clumsy. They used the state, they used police and informants and complex prison systems and the rest of it. That's very clumsy. That doesn't change anybody's mind. In the West, they make it impossible for you to function. They take over the very nature of language. Private sector bodies do the dirty work. So people think it's not the state. Therefore, it's popular consensus. Having no idea that the state is only one entity that can oppress people. Because the modern West uses private sector forces to do precisely what the Soviet state tried to do, makes it invisible. And to this day, we don't even have a language available to describe this public-private hybrid. I guess like everything else, because I'm going to have to do it, and then I'll be plagiarized by 1,000 people afterwards, who will then do far better than I. Oh, and speaking of which, tax season has passed us. I am asking my supporters to assist me again. My website, rustjournal.org, has a donation button, and I need your help. Angela Davis, to this day, is at major state institutions, pulling down $500,000 a year for absolutely no work. I mean, she does nothing except brainwashing. And I'm here. I have far more freedom, and then we're correct, factually correct, but that's cold comfort when I have to pay my bills. And what's happening is that there are many websites and writers out there who have taken my material lock, stock, and barrel. And you know who you are. And all I ask of you is a thank you. I was the first one to talk about this stuff in English. I was the first one to set out the theory, not just the historical fact, but the theory behind it in the English language, as early as the web's been around. And there's entire websites and journals. I don't think deliberately, but a lot of these places, they cite everybody in this field but me. That's strange. In some cases, it's just they heard it from me a long time ago and then they forgot where they found it and they just repeat it. I mean, we all do that. But all I ask of these people is a thank you once in a while. Thank you for doing the spade work here. So now we can enjoy and we now have a ready-made theory that you suffered over, was attacked over, lost jobs over. So a thank you would be nice. But apparently that's too much for you. And you're not going to admit a mistake now, so too bad. But you know you're doing the wrong thing. Footnote, once in a blue moon, would that kill you, really? You know? But I am the originator of this stuff. The way it's done now in English. And these sites, you know who I'm talking about. These guys, they're using the same phrases as I am. And as I did in the 90s. You know, that can't be a coincidence. So I thank you once in a while. You know, you're decent guys in every other area. So come on, give me a break here. But I do ask that you assist me. I mean, if you're not going to thank me, at least thank me that way. So what are we going to talk about? That's so similar to our clown world. Not anybody who is now associated or part of the justice system is in a lot of trouble, especially if there's an ideological aspect to it. Thank God in my divorce, there was nothing like this ever came up. The ideological side of this stuff was never brought up, so it went smoothly. In fact, I represented myself and I won. I won every confrontation. But when you're on trial but ultimately are political crimes. The nature of these trials is that the right, for the first time in decades, outnumbered these guys and used their tactics against them. And now the left, in the form of the state, in the form of the Lawyers Guild or whatever, has lost their minds. And the rule of law, of course, doesn't matter. It just depends on who writes the laws. And it's the rule of caprice. And you can't have a rule of law when you have a jury that doesn't know what the law is. Reasonable doubt is a very, very high standard. There's a reason for it to be high, but the average American juror doesn't know what that is. And I'm almost advocating to ask for a bench trial in some of these cases. Because unless the jury is 100% on your side, you'll have what Cosby had. They had a hung jury and they just tried him again. You know, I'm glad the state of Pennsylvania and the city of Philadelphia has all this extra money lying around. But there's always a reason behind this. And when you have basic questions like this, the violence of the left, the meticulous, you know, the claims about the drugs in Cosby, we can go on. You know that there's something more afoot. The Soviet Union, though, they used the state, a far more clumsy apparatus. However, they also used, in the 60s and 70s, they began to use psychiatric hospitals. I'm talking about a truly a great man, Major General Peter Grigorenko, the highest ranking dissident in Soviet history. Of course, Major General is almost as high as you can go. And it was tremendously embarrassing to the Soviet system when he turned around and fought it. But in his case, like with so many others, they used psychiatry as a way to get around the clumsiness of the state. I mean, the state can only do so much. You could have a machine gun nest on every roof. Well, how is that, you know, that's not sustainable. Even a prison system, that doesn't change anybody's mind. And the Soviet Union, just like the American Empire now, believes that history's come to an end. The truth of all human thought has been found. Advanced socialism was the announcement that the work of Marx had come to an end, finally. But not just the work of Marx, the work of the Enlightenment and the work of human history. But postmodern capitalism is identical. They see the so-called democratic and formal constitutions of government and the free choice of commodities as beyond question the ultimate good. The dissent from the unveiling of utopia must be a sign of illness. In the 60s and 70s, the USSR had much in common with the USA today. First of all, no one really believed in the slogans anymore, unless they profit from the rhetoric. It was just something you went through the motions, just like today, condemning, you know, hate and all that. It's just, you know, virtue signaling. That's all it was. Secondly, the older methods of production, this is specific to the Soviet Union, the things that the American investors built in the post-war era had reached their terminus. They were out of date, that the potential of this had fully been actualized, and now they were depreciating rapidly. Third, and this is what I'm getting at here, in these crisis periods, the use of mental illness is a common political weapon. And we hear it often. You know, you don't want to, you don't like what your opponent is saying. It's very easy to brand them as paranoid or sick or schizophrenic or something like that. You have an illness. Mentally ill people, in this view, they cannot reason and think in arbitrary chunks of word and sound. But once you are labeled this, there's no point in debating them. You have to destroy them or put them away. Another thing that they have in common is that high-profile members of this society are casting doubt on its most basic so-called virtues. For a regime like the Soviet system, nothing could be more frightening. For a man like Grigorenko, who had reached 4 stars, was very well known, you can't just shoot the guy. And for the same reason they didn't, why didn't they just shoot Solzhenitsyn? It's a very bad idea, especially in this era. Remember, you American and Western investment is pouring into this country. The U.S. was never at war with the USSR. It's easy enough to prove. You aren't trading vigorously with your enemy. But for a 4-star general, you can't really just shoot the guy. The people in charge of sending dissidents to prison can't themselves become dissident. It's not an accident, I don't think, a coincidence that this man is Ukrainian. And his first claim, early on, apart from the military stuff, is that the privileges of the Communist Party have no foundation in Marx, Lenin, or anybody else. Now, keep something in mind. You read Grigorenko in English and in Russian, as I've done. When he first starts making his points, he has to couch his rhetoric in the form of Marxism. So in his critique of the Soviet Union, he formed a group called the Society for the Preservation of Leninism. So in order to pass muster, he had to say, well, I am all about restoring the mind of Lenin, not overthrowing it. The short version of this story is that he was placed in the Sursky Institute, which was a mental asylum. He was officially diagnosed with paranoid delusions. But when he was released, he continued his work. He was then rearrested, resent back. And then his diagnosis says this precisely. He was afflicted with, and I quote, a paranoid development of the personality manifest by reformist ideas, end quote. So like Solzhenitsyn, he was exiled to the U.S. and he died, of course, completely unknown in 1987. The U.S. was so pro-Soviet that you had a 4-star general head of the, right in the so-called, you know, their version of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the Red Army, as an official dissident, an exile from his country, and no one knows who he is. Now, the psychiatric field has always bothered me. You know, Vladimir Moss is a psychologist, and he talks about my field, so I'm a historian, I'll talk about his field. But when you read the DSM-5, which is the listing of this diagnostic manual, when I first came across this, I was expecting, you know, science. I was expecting formulas and mathematics. No, it's a social science textbook. These are opinions. It's about maintaining the human norm. I thought it would be full of formulae and jargon. It is a purely social understanding of behaviors, and it has no pretense at all being medical. There is no pretense here that there is a chemical cause for this, or genetic cause, or something. And most of the entries here, and this is the official, this is the Bible of the psychiatric field in America, it's essentially irritating behaviors. This is just as an example. Narcissism. Here's the entry for narcissism. Listen to this. Individuals with a narcissistic personality disorder believe that they are superior, especially unique, and they expect others to treat them this way. They may feel like they can only be understood by those who are also special and of a high status, that they are unique, perfect, or gifted. Vulnerability and self-esteem makes individuals with narcissistic personality disorder sensitive to injury from criticism or defeat. They might not show it outwardly. Criticism may haunt these individuals and leave them feeling humiliated, degraded, hollow, and empty. They may react with rage. They may react with social withdrawal. Interpersonal relations, or they're impaired because of problems derived from entitlement, the need for admiration, relative disregard for sensitivities of others, sustained feelings of shame or humiliation, and the attendant self-criticism may be associated with social withdrawal, etc., etc., etc. It's on page 691. Now I'm reading this, and I'm saying, well, that only works if the person actually isn't unique or gifted. This could describe me. The only thing that what they need to say is that this has to be a delusion, that they're not special, that they're not gifted, they don't have a mission. They're not, in fact, in terms of whether knowledge or rationality or something like that, above the ignorant mass. Well, I'm certainly above the ignorant mass on my worst day. Vulnerability and self-esteem, you know, any of this, this is not a medical condition. Now, if someone, you used to call this megalomania, if someone believes that they're the king of Siam and is acting this way, you know, it's another matter. But if you actually are these things, then it's not a disorder. It's only a disorder if it is a delusion, but they don't say that. So the assumption in this, just this one particular, is a big entry and a very important one. The assumption here is that the person that views themselves as superior are not superior. I mean, gifted people are rarely understood. The average man has no idea how to treat these people. Of course, geniuses, they should have grandiose ideas, and they're never appreciated by the mass. And indeed, they are entitled to differential treatment, and they are sensitive, and people are envious. So in other words, you can have every single one of the so-called diagnostic criteria and be perfectly normal and centered and factual. What's my point here? My point is that in this area, the description is a form of social control. It assumes human equality. It assumes that we're the same. It assumes that we should all be treated the same, regardless of our contribution or our ability. It assumes that each person contributes roughly an equal amount to the social whole. It assumes that the criticism of a guy like this is correct, while the criticism coming from a patient is in fact delusion. The gifted or the advanced, they certainly do expect to be treated as such. The standards of the mass don't apply to the highly creative. But that is not explicitly stated here. In other words, You could speak as I do and many others do. You know, I could easily be labeled with this. Doesn't mean it's not true. You know, you talk about someone who is indeed a creative genius in music or something like that. Then it's not narcissism, it's just factual. But the diagnostic criteria here doesn't make the differentiation. In other words, this manual, the very Bible of this, that science in this country, it manifests the lowest common denominator. And the gifted people, in fact, don't exist. Well, I went to a gifted high school. You know, and I am different. And the worst part of it is that those who are resentful of those who are more intelligent than they are, they don't have to make actual arguments against the grandiosity of these people. They could just say now, you're sick. You see, look, you have all these criteria. Now I'm bringing this up because the exact same method was used in the USSR against Grigorenko. In both Soviet and American psychiatry, and this is exact quote, frequent clashes with authority figures is a sign of pathology over time. But when you say that a sign of being disturbed is frequent clashes with authority figures, the assumption behind that is that authority is legitimate and the troublemaker is not correct. In the Soviet case, the fact that Grigorenko and other dissidents, especially Grigorenko, because he had the access to the perks that he's condemning, that he can't see this, that he can't see the achievement of Soviet rule as advanced socialism. How can he not see this? He must be deluded. And it gets worse than this. Serious mental disorders are supposed to be detected very early, in the early stages. And for those who are concerned with your health, the Soviet system developed a notion of sluggish schizophrenia. I think that's a proper translation. Sluggish schizophrenia, where minor irritants, say a young man, where it's really just, you know, nothing too harmful, but if you string them all together in a report, these minor irritations could be seen as an early stage of severe schizophrenia. So therefore, any action can be interpreted as the early stages of something, and off to the Hotel California he goes. Now, in this country, it's very rare to find a political discussion anywhere that doesn't include a diagnosis of mental illness. Words like bipolar and paranoid are used all the time. But these are pseudo-clinical terms. The Soviet Union, as in America, they're used to silence dissent. It's meant to get the speaker off the subject. It's essentially ad hominem, and it's also dangerous. I want you to be careful when we all do this one time. Try to be very careful, though. Our opponents, they might actually be mentally ill, but we don't know that. They're wrong. They're stupid. You know, they're evil. They're destructive. But we have no idea if they're mentally ill or not. And it's dangerous because this is how the Soviets got rid of a large number of people. In the 1960s, Grigorenko began to speak out against the party oligarchy and the very high salaries. A strange thing is, when General Grigorenko began talking about the privileges of the Communist Party elite, the first accusation hurled against him was anti-Semitism, which of course carried a death sentence. It's the only crime against an ethnic group, any specific group at all, that carried a sentence like that, which validates the fact that the party is a Jewish front. And it's strange. He never brought up the Jews at all. And yet this is the first thing that he is accused of before they try to, diagnose him. They say, he's an anti-Semite. And he said, I'm not even talking about that. It didn't even come up. He didn't even think about it. Now, there were new party rules that were being developed at the time. And the purpose was to increase the turnover of officials. They wanted to debureaucratize the system. And of course, being a general, you know, they offered him very powerful bribes, and he refused. Over and over, he's accused of anti-Semitism in Pravda. And eventually, refusing to be a part of the system, he received an official reprimand, and his first real punishment was he was sent to the Far East, and he was sent to be the command of the Eastern Armies. At that time that he created the Union for the Struggle for the Revival of Leninism. And of course, the only way that you could do this, criticize the system in public is to say that, I'm working in the spirit of the early party. You couldn't protest anything unless you put it in those terms. So, on February 2nd, 1964, he was arrested under Article 70 of the Criminal Code. He was convicted immediately and sent to the Lubyanka Gulag in Moscow. Now, I've said many, many times here, I'll say it again, Soviet Marxism never had anything to do with labor, with workers, or anything else. It was a very small Jewish clique that used this kind of rhetoric for the sake of taking over the productive capacity of the country. Now, in the Russian mind at the time, the masses of the people, Leninism sometimes could be interpreted as Russian nationalism, like the Russian victory over Germany, for example. And the common people had no idea, the theoretical pomposity of Marx or Lenin. And they saw the party as a defender of Russia, not as a communist, the way we see it today. And we have to be very careful when we talk about these movements in Russia and the Soviet Union at the time, how the common people viewed it. After World War II, there was a tendency to see the party as a Russian nationalist group, because they defended the state against the Germans. Having no idea, Marx was such a minor aspect of any of this. It was about keeping people in power at the time. So he founded this group trying to eliminate career bureaucrats. Now, in the Soviet system, the concept of bureaucracy, it doesn't refer to administrators. We, in English, use that term to refer to the saying a bureaucrat as someone who works for an official administration. They work for the State Department or whatever it is. Now, in the Soviet world at the time, bureaucracy, you see it in Yugoslavia too, it refers to careerism. It refers to those who use their state position to charge rents. But that's exactly what the state was designed to do. So a bureaucrat was not defined as a government worker like it is in America. A bureaucrat, given the time period, was defined as a careerist that has no political convictions at all. It's just a functionary. And that this ruling class here had no real supervision. There was no ideology, really, no purpose and no vision. The state existed to extract resources from people. It was a protection racket. The worker state banned all labor unions and all independent labor activity. Anything that would lead to the betterment of labor was banned with violence. In Georgia at the time, Russia, striking workers were shot by the troops of the Interior Ministry. And so you had the worker state shooting workers who were demanding, in some cases, very minor things. Khrushchev can be a comic figure. While the Tsarist empire in by 1905 was feeding the world and was completely self-sufficient in food beyond anyone's wildest dreams, the Soviet system was fed by the West. Food shortages were everywhere, and it was all the time. You had a food strike in the Budyonny locomotive plant in 1961. Usually what would happen is that the management would come in and call the cops and they'd destroy the union. Now, frankly, the so-called worker state was far harsher on labor demands than the worst robber barons were in the USA. No factory manager heard or cared about labor issues. And shooting workers was the ordinary means of dealing with it. And if that's not proof that the USSR had nothing to do with workers or labor, but sort of nothing more than a Jewish party state. I don't know what to tell you. But in the same time, all production quotas were arbitrarily increased. So pay is going down as workloads are rising. Now, the KGB was always far more loyal than the army was, which in Grigorenko's case was made clear. And so KGB units were usually the ones relied upon to smash even the slightest complaint from workers in the worker state. In no other state in the world at the time were workers exploited with the viciousness as the worker state in the USSR. The strike, 26 workers were shot. The following morning, it continued again. 100 were arrested, 7 were executed on the spot. The rest received very long gulag terms. The story wasn't covered in the Soviet press, of course, and the American press, you know, very minor, you know, footnote stuff. Russians only learned about it in 92. Finally, the first Russian news report was released on it. This 1961 slaughter of workers by the worker state, this created Grigorenko's protest movement. Requesting actual worker control over the worker state would send him to prison. I mean, that's the bizarre world of the Soviet Union. But it's going to get worse. Food shortages in the Soviet Union were getting worse in the 60s. And under Khrushchev's incompetence, and to a great extent, you know, this food and the destruction, the waste was really mismanagement of these very same elites that are taking a huge chunk of the pie. Poor storage, you know, led to grain rotting or being eaten by rats. And what Grigorenko was worried about. The Soviets made a big deal of signing the Helsinki Accords, this human rights document, and he said, wait a minute, you know. Signing this is a big propaganda coup, but they're not going to do anything about it. Because it's a closed society, you know, this is him speaking here. In 1982, in the work Diplomatic Delusions, this is my translation here. He says this, remaining the closed society that it is, the USSR was given full freedom to violate any of the treaty's provisions, while the West, which actually takes treaties seriously, would scrupulously fulfill the provisions of the Articles, the final act, thereby ensuring the full security of the Soviets. This was only advantageous to the USSR. For the West, it's very dangerous because it creates in the free world an illusion of security that tends to leave the democratic countries defenseless. In other words, it was a method of propaganda. So in signing these accords, the USSR was able to pose as a state evolving towards Western human rights. But no one had really unobstructed access to the country. So how do you prove otherwise? And the American press was always enamored with the workers' paradise. But Grigorenko says this, we have clouds of bureaucratic locusts. It's hard to misinterpret the term parasite. A non-parasite is one who, not being in state service or receiving salaries from the state, earns their bread with their own hands. The parasite is the one who, all his life, runs regularly to and from work without doing anything useful for our race and our people. In 1978, he says that, for our race and our people. Now, what he's saying there is, you know, no one can disagree with. I don't care what your background is. But at the time, no one believed in, you know, to talk about Lenin was just virtue signaling at the time. People who ruled the state had positions of power, and they adapted themselves to the regime. They were just chameleons. Some were opportunists, but there were a handful who were actually real, legitimate psychopaths. Everything was inverted. In his protest movement, he says this about nationalism. Remember, he's Ukrainian, so this actually is a big deal to him. Each nation has the full right to be master of its own land, to have a complete independent state. On this basis, for all the peoples of the Soviet Union, recognize the right to national independence. This should be recognized without any reservations or conditions. It can't be obscured with hypocritical ideologies from third parties. These issues have nothing to do with self-determination. On the contrary, this can only infringe on the sovereign rights of a people and interfere with its internal affairs. Relationships with other peoples should be based on the understanding that smaller, weaker states will gain strength over time. Then they could be dealt with on equal footing. He says this in 1980. I mean, technically, the Soviet Constitution gave republics the right to secede, but just like the Helsinki Accords, it's just pieces of paper. Now, Western journalists, they get blinded by rhetoric very easily, and they're very easy to manipulate, especially when they want to be manipulated. And something else he says in 1980 in the same work, he says this. He says that these visible signs don't make the Soviet Union the Russian Empire. If it were a Russian Empire, it would be dominated by Russian culture. Yet this culture has been banned and doesn't get appropriated by other republics. And the Soviet Union, including Russia, instead of Russian culture and other national cultures, like the Ukrainian, what dominates instead is the party oligarchy and the anti-culture of socialist realism. Now, it's common for Ukrainian nationalists to view, and they're wrong about this, to view the Soviet Union as a Russian nationalist institution or a Russian ethnic institution. That's stupid. And what Grigorenko, as a Ukrainian, says quite clearly is, if that were the case, then it would actually be Russian. And it's not. Russian culture, which of course is the Orthodox culture, is banned. They have a few ornamental things that they like to show off, but otherwise, anything traditional was gone. In 1980, he wrote a letter to the Soviet dictator, Andropov. He also was the former KGB chief. He says this to him. This society is always a struggle for the few, a minority, to impose its influence on the bulk of the population. None of these minorities speak the truth at all. Their infallibility and omniscience are parasitic only on ignorance and violence. In fact, a particular minority at this state may come closer to the truth. This minority requires the suppression of the majority. Yet in a free society, this could never occur. Nowhere in the world does it exist a society that could be called free. Even in countries with a broad democracy, the minority still rules by attaching incentives to support them and using this to prevent the views of others to spread. As for countries with a totalitarian regime, all differing opinions that don't meet the views of the powers that be are physically suppressed. There's no normal development of social life. There is, on the other hand, a strengthening of the decay of social institutions and the accumulation of popular anger. And he goes on. Actually, earlier, in 1973, he says, at the beginning of the century, meaning roughly 1900, the Bolsheviks would hardly have been given 0.1% of popular support. After 15 years, the whole Russia followed them. That he's being figurative there. Based on the principles of Marxism, the low number of opponents is not a cause of victory of ideas, but only force. We should ensure that people get the opportunity for an unlimited acquaintance with the views of the opposition. Anything else is weakness. Any truth can only be ensured through the struggle of ideas. Fear here is a loss of privilege. Marxism-Leninism follows the other path, the claim of the unity of the people, an obvious falsehood, the abnormality in the development of society. It is seriously ill. There is no opportunity for the struggle of opinions. There is therefore no social development. So even in the mid-70s, he has completely deviated from his Leninist thinking. He's not even couching his words in official doctrine anymore. He is no fan of Western liberalism. The myth that the party is this workers' advocacy group was probably the most obnoxious of all the Soviet myths. When the Soviet ruling class used the phrase working class or worker, it's a technical term that they understood the meaning of. It had nothing to do with workers or proletarians. The official doctrine was a worker referred to someone who accepted the regime. And then it wasn't very well. He rejected Marxism entirely. And when he went into exile, he said, you know, he rejected it 100%. Now, being a veteran of World War II, One of his very early critiques was that the huge number of Russian casualties that the Germans took very early on was Stalin's fault. Remember, in the post-war era, even in de-Stalinization, Stalin was still this, great soldier and fighter for the people. But he says this about Stalin. He says, only in the 20th Congress of the Communist Party, in 30 June 1956, even they pointed to Stalin as the main culprit in the mistakes, miscalculations that put our state on the brink of disaster and led to our troops to the stunning losses in the first months of the war. Full disclosure of Stalin's mistakes and miscalculations are not given in these materials. Such a task can only be taken up by actual Marxists guided by party decision. And this point was essential. Now, of course, that last sentence was purely sarcastic. No such a serious task can only be taken up by Marxists and guided benignly by party decision. Now, the mistakes weren't Stalin's personally, but these were built into the whole system. The moment this was exposed, the state clamped down. The theory is that it would start a chain of criticism and would encourage more systematic historical work. Now, we see this now in the United States, where even basic criticism of the regime is condemned in the most violent terms. The belief is, if people start criticizing small bits of the system, it won't be long before they begin seeing things more systematically. That's my whole purpose. My personal purpose here is to lay out an entire philosophical theory where all of our problems can be brought under. And this is what Grigorenko is saying is happening in the USSR at the time. And this is, 1975 to 1980. By the way, he also strongly suggests here that the USSR was going to attack Germany. Now he was there. Grigorenko's accusation is that all forms of local initiative have been destroyed. Now, he says this. He says before the war, he said the USSR was armed to the teeth, and that this was essentially an offensive movement. He doesn't come out and say it, but he does wonder why it is you had huge numbers of men without proper barracks stationed on the western borders of the empire in the late 30s. By 1941, it was very clear that you had this huge massing of forces, and that once the Germans invaded, you had these huge casualties the USSR suffered because they were getting ready to invade. Now, I don't know. I think he's making this accusation, very obliquely. He can't come out and say it because he's still in the USSR at this time. But he's making the claim that Hitler invaded the Soviet Union as a defensive measure. And this is extremely important. The other person to make that argument was General Lebed, who of course was a major nationalist politician in the 90s. Grigorenko, like a lot of dissidents, began to realize that the West was not opposed to the Soviet Union. They may have been opposed to its expansion, but that has nothing to do with ideology. He says this, or really kind of says this in an indirect way, condemning the West. He says this: enough. The West's mistake lies in its failure to exploit the Soviet system's weaknesses in its diplomacy by not assisting nations to recognize the criminal nature of that system, by not relying on oppositional elements, especially the nationalists, by not supporting these movements. Brazen Soviet diplomacy, stumbling on a firm and stable purpose, would find itself in a hopeless situation. In other words, he's saying that the U.S. has every means to destroy the USSR and will not. Now, of course, I don't think he really means this. as if the entire diplomatic colossus of the USSR can't figure this out. But the reality is, American capital was so heavily invested in the USSR that to destroy the system would lead to chaos. From computers to automotives, the USSA was invested in and profiting from the Soviet Union. Now you notice, there was never any point in time where the U.S. put sanctions on the Soviet Union except the invasion of Afghanistan. And that was very brief. Jimmy Carter says that all of our, you know, giant investment projects are going to be put on hold. Well, I thought there was a Cold War. How can there be giant investment projects? Well, there was a very powerful brisk trade with all the Soviet dictators. It's Putin who gets sanctioned. Grigorenko, being essentially a Ukrainian man, he had to promote himself as a Leninist because anything else would mean automatic prison and far worse than he ever experienced. In essence, he's using Leninism in a coded way. But needless to say, he's living in the USSR. He describes his life. He cannot say. He has to use code words. He defines the concept of democracy as a set, series of rights, public education, oversight of public functions, criticism. But all of these require basic freedoms to function. You can't be a critic when you're preoccupied with basic needs. Only when these are met, as a matter of course, can any real civic action take place. Otherwise, everything is basic survival. He was the purest of the dissidents. He could have led a very easy life. He would have been a hero and got whatever he wanted. And he says this in his memoirs. Whoever wanted to destroy tyranny had to eliminate within himself the fear of tyranny. He had to take up his cross and ascend Golgotha, let people see him, and through him their desire to partake in the march will awaken. Let people see those who follow him, and they too will follow. Look, for those who are being persecuted and prosecuted, whether it be Charlottesville or anything else, remember these words. This is the beginning. There's no way that anyone could have possibly seen the domino effect that came to destroy the USSR in the 70s, early 80s. But he did. And all it takes is one or two people. People will witness this. Suffering activists, our people suffering. And only because of that, our desire to imitate him will awaken. They won't be frightened. They'll want to fight. To a great extent, the Slavic stock of the old Soviet Union was really better off than American postmodern. The USSR had the positive effect of keeping some of the worst of the American media out. Grigorenko was sent to the asylum when his dissent became chronic. The dominance over the mind is the ultimate goal of the tyrant. The mass mind, when it sees a dissident, immediately assumes a mental illness. In the beginning, I mentioned something called sluggish schizophrenia, and this is something that we need to take seriously in America. It was developed by Andrei Shinevsky, and as I mentioned before, it just says that the tiniest little thing could be seen as a very, very early manifestation of a later mental illness. Well, there could be any. It's completely arbitrary. But because what I've mentioned in the DSM-5 and how the mental illness racket works in America. And there are actual mental illnesses, obviously. The brain is an organ and can malfunction like anything else. But that's not what I'm talking about. Mental illness is the only field of medicine where physical exams aren't necessary for a diagnosis. Or medication, for that matter. Only the self-description of the patient. The patient must interpret his feelings and why these are pathological. The doctor must then reinterpret these from the standard text, the DSM. So it's a subjective interpretation of an interpretation. Now, these tactics are being used. the concept of these, you know, I mentioned the narcissism definition, because this is extremely, you know, anyone could be brought under this. You know, a symptom. We're not talking about, you know, something that could be measured scientifically. Something that irritates people. Here's how they define sluggish schizophrenia. Someone who is early onset schizophrenia was typified by a poor level of social adaptation, regular conflict with authority figures. This could be viewed as a slippery slope to severe mental breakdown. And so we need to treat these people immediately. You see, part of his diagnosis was that how come Gregorenko just doesn't shut up? He could have had anything he wanted. He could have had mansions, women, security, travel, whatever he wanted. But of course, he needed justice too. His conscience demanded it. But the refusal of this life of ease is symptomatic of mania. How can anyone turn that down? Well, if you believe that humans are purely pleasure-seeking animals, then yeah, it's true. But the pseudoscience from Andrei Shinovsky, and he, you know, he was known by his students as a, you know, he was a phony. But this is developing here now. One concept here was the beginning of religiosity and even depression. At any given moment means that someone may be developing schizophrenia. And so you got to put them away now so that they don't get worse. A dissenter, by our very nature, I mean, I could talk personally here, we're all going to be sensitive and very highly strung. This life that we lead, and that he led, although far, far harder core than us, this life leads to recriminations from family, a loss of friends, poor sleep. This means that dissidents are more apt to shift from one mood to another, be cranky and depressed. So it's so easy, even for a well-meaning person, to see us as half-nuts because of the life that we lead. I read the Handbook of Psychiatry in Russian, and the political, in the Soviet era, the concept of delirium points out that any view that a group of people is being persecuted when no one else thinks they are is a symptom of severe mental illness. Also, when anyone is convinced that they're being watched or followed, or something is going on against their will, they too are likely to be on the verge of a breakdown. This is a man who signed the diagnostic papers of Gregorenko. The Soviet view was totalitarian. The class status was the main determinant of attitudes and ideology. So psychiatry had to be political. And, you know, Walter Reich in 1983, he interviewed Dostoevsky. And he talked about this kind of sluggish idea that you could throw anyone away early on. And he got very defensive. His student from Armenia said, well, you know, they mentioned Gregorenko saying that, you know, his dissent was a sign of a mental illness. He says the following. Look, Gregorenko, when he was here, he was sick. He's a remarkable man, but he got involved with the Crimean Tartars. He got fixated on them and a few other causes. When you and others re-examined him, he was in the States, away from all that stress, and he was okay. Other characteristics have been, and Reich says this, they've been attributed to dissonance like ambivalence, guilt, internal conflicts, behavioral disorganization, excessive belief in ideals, obsessive attention to detail. These kind of things, in isolation, could be seen as mania. But for a dissident, this is how we live. So the very act of being a dissident meant you got thrown in, you could be thrown in jail or thrown in a mental institution. And even American psychologists finally condemned this at one point, because these were the grounds on which Gregorenko was imprisoned. To be a dissident is to lead a hard life. To lead a hard life is almost by definition to be moody and difficult. Gregorenko, and I know I tried to claim quite a bit, I'm sorry, cram quite a bit here in this hour. But Gregorenko slowly but surely became more radical in his criticism of the Soviet system, starting off by saying that, well, it's deviating from Leninism by having this party oligarchy, and then near the end, nationalists, whether it be Crimea or Ukraine or anything else. And then the system had enough. Now in America, the guy at Yale University, John Gardner, at a conference, he says this: "We have an ethical responsibility to warn the public about Donald Trump's dangerous mental illness. He's paranoid, delusional, grandiose, all this." So what's happening here? What's happening is they're going to use this very method. It could be Trump, could be anybody. To have him relieved of power on the grounds he's not fit for office. And you could have an army of MDs signing off on this, using the same method that they used in the Soviet system. The point of all of this is that the left is medicalizing dissent. Grigorenko was condemned for the very act of being a dissident. He became more radical as time went on. The more radical you get, the more difficult your life is. Grigorenko was reduced to selling vegetables in Siberia on the side of the road. He had nothing else left. He was reduced. I mean, he was at the pinnacle of power, joint chiefs of staff of the Soviet military, four-star general, and in a fairly brief period of time, he's on the side of the road in the middle of nowhere selling vegetables. And he said, you know what? He came to America. He said, you know, this was the first time that I was free. This is the first time that I was a human being. This is the first time that I was actually happy, when I was in dire poverty selling vegetables on the side of the road. What happened to Grigorenko is happening now all over the place. The concept of sluggish schizophrenia means that any dissident behavior, any conflict with authority, can be seen as the beginnings of this slippery slope to total breakdown, and you can be put away. And when you have psychiatrists talking about saying that Donald Trump has a mental illness, you can then build a medical case saying he needs to be relieved of office. Now, that's going on last year. I don't know if this is still going on. But this is what happens when you medicalize dissent and psychiatry. Psychiatry was always a political movement, always a very Judaic movement. But it's so easy to look at one of us and say, no, you're crazy. Look at how you live. Look at how upset you always are. Oh, you're always arguing, damn it. Well, of course, that's what our life is. Grigorenko went from one movement to another, always arguing, always, and the man could have led a life of absolute utopian ease. If you believe that a human being is only a pleasure-seeking machine, then yeah, put him away. There's something wrong with him. It's precisely because the Soviet Union didn't see the soul that they couldn't make any sense out of this guy. How can he not want this? He's a four-star general. He's heading toward... He was just on the verge of retirement. That's not... The man with... You know, how can he possibly do this? When you don't believe in the soul, therefore you can't believe in freedom, free will, it makes no sense. So they put him in a cell, they drugged him up. And unfortunately, that may be the fate for a lot of us. As I've always said, I define a brother or a friend as someone who has a very good chance of sharing a gulag cell with me. So for many of you, you are my brothers and friends. And as we're being persecuted beyond belief, think about General Grigorenko selling vegetables on the side of the road, in and out of prison, experimented on with drugs, finally exiling him to America to deafening silence. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.